that I did with Douglas Spoiler and Catherine Friesen, various other collaborators, Jerry Selwood and Peter Bonenheimer. Douglas Spoiler is a graduate student currently at the University of Santa Cruz, and I need to give him the credit for pushing for this project. This work was posted on the archive more than a year ago in May 2007. And the story is that for about a year, we were giving talks about this and were very much ridiculed. But now the community, I mean, this topic has received quite a boost and a momentum, and there's quite a competition out there to study this, the effect of dark matter on the first stars. So this is the bottom line. The cold dark matter particles can dramatically alter the formation of first stars, leading to a new stellar phase powered by CDM annihilation instead of nuclear fusion. We call it a dark star. Some consequences are that this formation of dark stars affects the reionization in the early universe and the evolution of the element abundances. Also, dark stars may be precursors to the supermassive black holes that power high redshift quasars. So you know there are some quasars that are observed at redshift higher than 6. And if you try to form those supermassive black holes by merging, that's simply not enough time to form them. So I'm helped here with by Liang Gao. Yes.
Second part on the supermassive black holes. How you form black holes with that?
We haven't completed the whole thing, but I will tell something. So the, as I said, Liang Gao, the previous speaker, just gave a nice introduction to what is a standard picture for the first stars. But the basic properties are that they're made only of hydrogen and helium. They form inside dark matter halos of 10 to the power 10 to the 6 solar masses at redshifts of about, say, 10 to 50. They're important because they are the end of the dark ages. They reionize the universe, and they provide enriched gas for later stellar generations. Now, when you add dark matter to population 3 stars, then the dark matter that is in the protostellar halos alters the formation of the population 3 stars. What happens is that the dark matter annihilation heats the collapsing gas cloud and impedes its further collapse, and so it halts the march of the protostar toward the main sequence. This is what gives rise to a new stellar phase powered by dark matter annihilation. Yes?
You mentioned that these top 3 stars reionize the universe and they also enrich the
yes.
universe. So those are two different things. You would imagine that after some amount of enrichment, the IMF would seg from top 3 stars to more normal stars. And then there's certain some threshold of ionizing photons necessary to ionize the universe. Do you have?
That's all right, but that's not the topic of my talk. That is a standard scenario of population 3 stars and their effect on the universe.
You know which of those two things happens first? That was, I guess, my question. If you wanted to look at the reionizing source of the universe, you'd want to make sure that the enrichment wasn't so effective that it was actually popular source of
it depends very much on the mass of the star and the medium environment. So I don't think there's a definite answer to your question.
People said probably just that only contribute 1% of reionization photons.
Okay, so this is going to be the outline of my talk. I'll very quickly mention again the standard picture for first stars. Then I'll talk more extensively about dark matter, the Wonder Wind, and the density profile of dark matter. And then the mechanism of dark matter annihilation, so the heat source, and a new stellar phase and some observable consequences. So first stars, standard picture. The first stars are the first luminous objects ever. They may, as I said, made only of hydrogen and helium and form inside dark matter halos. Initially, the baryons are the cosmological abundance of 15%. Formation of first stars is a gentle process. Now, the dominant cooling mechanism that allows collapse is H2 cooling. This is done by Hollenbach, realized by Hollenbach and McKee in 1979. So simulations from paper by Liang Gao and others, and from Abel and so on, and that show the dark matter and the gas at redshift 60 evolved to redshift 48. And these are the same figures that the Liang showed in the previous talk. So the dark matter filaments, you see them here very clearly. Then you know very well what happens to CDM. The gas initially has very low fluctuations, but then collapses into forming these nuggets for the first stars. This is a thermodynamic evolution of the gas. The gas number density on the horizontal axis spans many orders of magnitude, and the gas temperature is very restricted range instead. So there's an adiabatic contraction at the beginning. Then, thanks to the H2 line cooling, the temperature decreases. There's a loitering phase, which is almost in local thermodynamic equilibrium. Then heat is released, and then there's some other reactions that kick in until eventually one reaches an adiabatic phase and the contraction of the star through a Kelvin-Helmholtz phase into the main sequence. So very quickly, the H2 cooling is very sensitive. The rate of H2 cooling is very sensitive to the density of the gas. At low densities, this case is a square, and at higher densities, about 10 to the 4, just linear. And what is important is that this effect produces a change in the fraction of molecular to atomic hydrogen. It starts very low and then increases. The three-body reaction in the later stage at 10 to the 8 per centimeter cube is a reaction of three hydrogen atoms producing H2, so it becomes 100% molecular. And this is what helps in cooling the star. At 10 to the 10 per centimeter cube, there's opacity kicks in, there's the less efficient cooling. And proceeding quickly at higher and higher densities, there are more phenomena like collision-induced emission as the molecules get polarized when they go nearby each other, and you have emission and dissociation atomic. Eventually, a mini core forms at a density of about 10 to the 22 per centimeter cube with a temperature around 20,000 Kelvin. So this is the standard picture. Just the mass scales. So we know we're talking about the genes mass for a 10 to the 4 per centimeter cube is around 1,000 solar masses. And then in the center core mass, instead, is 10 to the minus 3 solar masses at the end. Finally, in the standard scenario, you get a star which is around 100 solar masses. This is really an order of magnitude to estimate it could go from a few solar masses to several hundreds. So what about dark matter? I remind you of the case of for non-baryonic dark matter. The best thing that I could put together is this one. Is a Ness Sloan paper from a couple of years ago. It's the baryon fraction on the vertical axis and the matter density omega m on the horizontal axis. And you see two lines. The yellow ellipse here is from the measurement of the relative peak heights in the CMB spectrum, and it gives the omega baryon. And the cyan line, or blue line, blue region here, is instead from the break in the matter power spectrum. So it doesn't show here, but on the left of this, you have the primordial slope of the P of K given by inflationary fluctuations. And then it breaks at the matter radiation equality. So when K corresponds to the horizon and matter radiation equality. So this gives you the ratio of omega matter to omega radiation. So you find omega matter in this way, and it gives you this blue region. And you see there is an intersection here, and what we can get out of this graph is that the matter density is 0.2, but the baryon fraction is only 15 to 20%. So this is one of the best evidence for non-baryonic dark matter that I could put together. So the one that I couldn't find a picture of a Winslow with Viney up there, is a weakly interacting massive particle. The important point for this talk is that a WIMP in chemical equilibrium in the early universe naturally has the right density to be called dark matter. So what happens is at early times, WIMPs are produced in a plus and minus or plus and minus and so on collisions in the Hall primordial soup. This is called thermal production. Then the WIMP production ceases when the production rate becomes smaller than the Hubble expansion rate. We call that the freeze out. And after freeze out, the co-moving number density of WIMPs remains constant. is the important point that the wind annihilation cross-section determines its cosmological density. This is a famous graph showing the moving number density of winds as a function of time. It's actually mass over temperature, we can read it as time. At the beginning, they're in chemical equilibrium, and then after freeze out, the density remains constant. The important relation that comes out of these calculations is that the relative density of WIMPs is inversely proportional to their annihilation cross section. And if the annihilation cross section is around the weak interaction scale, like here, 3×10⁻²⁶ centimeters cubed per second, then we get a density which is equal to the cold dark matter density of about 0.11. So this will be our candidate WIMP cold dark matter. Our canonical case will be this, just the annihilation I just showed to you that gives the right density. And the mass as a benchmark would be 100 GeVs. Now, the mass of the WIMP is not so well defined from this Wander WIMP argument. So we consider a range of masses from 1 GeV to 10 TeVs, and also a range of cross sections so that our results can apply to various WIMP candidates, like the supersymmetric particle, the neutralino, or Kaluza-Klein particles in extra dimensions, those neutrinos. So in particular, I want to point out that the supersymmetry is a theory that is very much appreciated by the particle physicists. So here's a quote from David Gross, who was asked at a lunch what he expects from the Large Hadron Collider, and that was his answer: supersymmetry, supersymmetry, supersymmetry. So the largest supersymmetric particle is most often the neutralino. It is the most popular WIMP dark matter candidate. The mass is between 1 GeV and 10 TeVs. Now, neutralinos are their own antiparticles. They annihilate with themselves. And the annihilation rate comes purely from particle physics and automatically gives the right answer for the relative density. So that's why they're so popular as a WIMP CDM candidate. But again, our work is not limited to neutralinos. It involves all CDM particles that can annihilate. So current searches for WIMP dark matter are many and vigorous. The Large Hadron Collider, as I said, is hopefully will find supersymmetry and perhaps even produce some dark matter particles. Direct detection, we heard a talk by Ryan Green. This is an example of a CDMS detector. This finding WIMPs on Earth. And then in various categories of indirect detection through neutrinos from the sun or the Earth, or particles like gamma rays, positrons, antiprons, producing Milky Way halo in external galaxies, the galactic center. There are many searches for these. I want to say here that indirect detection, when you use the same annihilation cross section that determines the WIMP relative density, apart from kinematical factors that S wave and P wave. And so we're talking about the same process that is used, the annihilation process that is used to produce the density of WIMPs is the process that is used to try to detect them indirectly and is the process that we're going to use for in the first step. The annihilation of the neutralinos is important in this, oh, this I just said, it's important to know these cases. So let me move on to the density profile for dark matter. So we're getting closer to the work on the dark stars. Initially, we take an NFW profile with 15% variance. We also have a core profile that we use as a check to see if we're too sensitive to the central cusp, and we're not. As the gas contracts, the dark matter is dragged in. And now we have to study how much it is, by what amount it is dragged in. So here's some results from simulations by Abel, Brian, and Norman in 2002. You see the number density on the vertical axis. It's number density for the gas and also number density for the dark matter, some lines that you can almost barely see. The radius extends from 10⁻⁶ parsecs to 10⁻²⁰ parsecs. So let me guide you through this. These are the colors correspond to different time in the evolution of the protostar. The blue lines is the beginning. So this is the gas profile at the beginning. And if you see on the right, is this. On the right, these dots here following the blue line are the initial dark matter profile. This is one of the few simulations, actually this is the only simulation we could find that follows the dark matter to such small scales. And then as the gas evolves and the protostar forms, you go up there. And the dark matter at the end corresponding to this curve up there is this line here that extends to about 10 to minus 2 parsecs. Yes, they are, and in fact, if you
space with the dark matter.
Well, this was the simulation, and where we are to extend this to lower radii, we can surface space. That would be our tool.
You don't have to compute. I mean, you can do this analytically.
That's right. That's what we did.
And you have done it.
Yes.
Because simulations don't always conserve phase states.
Exactly. So what we did, I can show you now. We can exchange the parameters in the NFW profile with the virial mass and the concentration parameter. But this is what we do. To extend the simulations below 0.01 parsecs, we use adiabatic contraction. There are different methods for adiabatic contraction. The first thing we did is to use a prescription from Blumenthal, Faber, Flores, and Primack in 1986. It's a simplified thing, and I'll tell you how it is simplified. But first, the big picture. As the baryons fall into the core, the dark matter particles respond to the change in the potential well. So at the beginning, we have the baryons under dominant, only 15%. And then in the core, the baryons dominate. And so the potential in the center is dominated by the baryons. The dark matter just comes in. It's like if you were in a potential that gets deeper, you would fall in. Now, the Blumenthal et al. Prescription is simplified in the sense that it assumes circular orbits and conserves the only angular momentum and not the full complement of actions, radial action, and so on. So if you have angular momentum conservation, then you find that the product of R times the mass contained is constant. I could derive it with.
There's a box. So this is a very simple derivation. You know, V square is Gm over R. That's the Kepler law. Yeah, it is a law for a circular orbit. And the angular momentum per unit mass is R times V. So you apply the same, and you get the square root of Gmr. And then is the mass within the radius r. So you see that angular momentum conservation of circular orbits and mass to conserving the product of the radius times the mass internal to that. So that's Blumenthal's prescription. So once we do this, we find contracted the dark matter profile. It slopes as r to minus 1.9 outside a core given by this expression around 5 to 3 per centimeter cube, and then multiplied by the density of the baryons. So here is some pictures and of the profile we get. In blue is the original NFW profile. And then at different times, we can track the dark matter. For example, at green is barely visible. But let's take the purple at 10 to 13 centimeters cubed in the gas density. This is this line is the contracted dark matter profile. We repeat the same thing for a core profile at Burker. Example, so to check if the central density is very sensitive to our assumptions of a Kusky NFW profile. And it is not, see here, we're about one order of magnitude less, but as I say in a second, this doesn't change the effect, it only delays the formation of the solar dark star. As a check, the incredible thing is that this analytic calculation matches the numerical one by Al O'Brien and Norman. And I'm going to show you that, of course, in the region where we can compare them. So that this is, again, radius and dark matter density. These are the points from the numerical simulation. And the red line is our adiabatic profile. So we have exactly the same slope as in the simulations, but just conserving phase space. So we take this as a degree of confidence that we're doing it right. However, this is an adiabatic contraction and with a Bowman cup prescription, so we would like to check it. The adiabatic contraction is very good when the dynamic flow time is shorter than the I always get this opposite. So when the dynamical time is longer than the orbital time, so the particles go around many times before the potential changes. Now, the caveat here is that we use in spherical symmetry. In reality, there may be mergers or formation of disks and bars. So as I say, we're happy that our final latent profile matches the numerically thin profile in the relevant regime. Now, I have to say that adiabatic contraction a la Blumenthal has been used in describing galactic dark matter halos, and it has worked, and it works even in regimes where you don't expect it to work. Why it is so, it is not very clear. For example, Selwood and McGaugh in 2005 published a paper on using adiabatic contraction for galaxies, even in the presence of radial orbits, disks, and bars, and so on, and they found that the Blumenthal prescription is off only by factors 4 to 1. So we have done full phase test analysis following a paper by Peter Young in 1980, and we have n-body simulations in progress with Marcel Zen and UC Santa Cruz. So here is our result for the complete phase conservation using all the actions. It differs from the Blumenthal prescription only by a factor of 2. This is the original NFW profile. And the solid lines are what you obtain using conserving all the actions of phase space. Blumenthal is just angular momentum. And so here you see, for example, you can get 1 times 10 to the 8 with Blumenthal and 2 times 10 to the 8 with Young. So sometimes you get even a higher density conserving the radial action in addition to angular momentum. And if you repeat this for the core profile is a very similar result. We're within a factor of 2 Blumenthal, except in the most extreme case here where we have some numerical problems.
Could you remind us what are the difference between the two cases?
So the Blumenthal prescription is conservation of angular momentum only assumes circular orbits. The Young prescription instead assumes an isotropic distribution and conservation of radial action and angular momentum. So it's a more complete calculation.
You have 2 curves, but we have 3 curves. One is NFW and the other 2, I mean, the solid curves.
There are 3 different times.
There are 3 different times.
3 different times.
So which kind of simulation you are using? You are using here?
Here, there's no simulation. There's no simulation here. It's an analytic formula that is involves an integral because it is sort of what it calls an edit calculation or something. So it involves an integral, so you do the integral numerically, but it's analytic in the core. The numerical simulation we're working on, and we don't have the results yet. Okay, so dark matter heating. The heating rate from dark matter contains 2 factors. There's some amount of energy Qn that is produced per annihilation, and then that energy needs to be absorbed by the gas in the star, and we call that factor Fq. That the fraction of annihilation energy that is deposited in the gas. So first, the annihilation rate is given by a standard formula. It is square of the number density of WIMPs, because this is a chemical reaction, will be 2 particles, so we have a square, times the annihilation per section times the mass of the WIMP, this gives the energy released. And for the fraction of annihilation energy deposited, I'm going to work to the next slide. I want to comment here that previous work did look at this phenomenon, but only stopped at densities below 10 to the 4 per centimeter cube, where annihilation products escape. So it couldn't heat up for the star. So what about the fraction of energy deposited in the gas? We have a simple estimate for the moment. We have a better calculation in progress. We assume, based on our experience with neutrinos, that a third of the energy goes into neutrinos that escape from the star, and the other 2/3 go into charged particles and photons, so electrons, positrons, and photons. For the electrons, high energy electrons above the critical energy of 280 MeV in a plasma with a primordial composition, those electrons form electromagnetic cascades, while the lower energy electrons ionize the medium. For photons, above 100 MeV, again, we have electromagnetic escapes, and below 100 MeV, we have quantum scattering or tungsten scattering. So we put all this particle physics, very well-known particle physics, being verified in laboratory experiments for decades. So this allows us to evaluate the amount of energy deposited into the star, and this is what happens. There's a crucial transition. At sufficiently high gas densities, most of the annihilation energy is trapped inside the core and heats it up. When this happens depends on the mass of the particle. For a particle of 1 GeV, it happens when the density is 10 to the 9 centimeter cube. And if you go to 10 TeV, it happens later when the density is 10 to the 5 centimeter cube.
Doesn't that depend on how big the system is?
Yes, how big it is, we take from the simulations of the baryon collapse.
Starting at 10 to the 10.
Yes. So what happens at this transition is that the dark matter heating dominates overall cooling mechanism. And this impedes the further collapse of the core. There's a slight dependence on the concentration parameter that, however, is negligible. If we change the concentration parameter within a reasonable range, we lower the density by a factor of 4. So instead of going to a certain density, varying density, we need to go to a density which is 16 times higher. So this means that we're going to produce a dark star, but a little bit later when the density is higher.
So where along, so earlier you showed a plot that showed the different phases of
yes.
the formation. So where along that curve are we?
Okay, so here's the answer to your question. So this is temperature and number density again. The blue line is the curve that I showed before. It looks a little bit different here. This is a crowded figure, but focus just on one of these lines. This red line marked 100 GeV, because the other red lines correspond to different particle masses. So above this red line, cooling dominates over the dark matter heating. Below the red line, the dark matter heating is stronger than the cooling. So what happens is that you can follow the evolution of the protostar along the blue line, and a certain density here, the dark matter heating dominates. That's where the collapse stops. Now, if you change the dark matter mass, and say you go to 10 TeVs, keeping the same annihilation cross-section, then the crossing occurs a little bit later. If you do it for the 1 GeV particle, then the crossing occurs sooner, either here or there, depending on the molecular composition of the star. It's completely molecular hydrogen or atomic. Yes. The cooling is all the processes that I mentioned at the beginning.
You're not including molecular hydrogen.
We are.
But the molecules are destroyed by the ionizing radiation.
Yes and no. That effect is unimportant here, okay, where we don't have molecular hydrogen because it's destroyed. So let me start over, okay? So about molecular hydrogen. So at high masses, like 100 GeV or 10 TeV, molecular hydrogen is destroyed. So we don't have to worry about it. At the mass of 1 GeV instead, it could be destroyed or could not, according to the density and very specific things. So what we have done here, we plotted two lines, one corresponding to molecular hydrogen and the other no molecular hydrogen. So that is destroyed. So now I forgot which is which, but what happens, the key point here is that whatever the assumption we make about the molecular hydrogen or non-molecular, the mass of the particle, the cross-section, we have a robust result that the red lines cross the evolution of the star, of the protostar. We include all the processes, the free body reactions, the collision of induced emission, the H2, the line cooling.
Tend to the third degrees, the baryons are not ionized. After all, there's all this ionizing radiation from the annihilation. Is there enough to ionize?
So at the near this point,
yes, there is enough to ionize.
And the endothermal Bremsstrahlung at low temperature is very effective, isn't it?
Thermal Bremsstrahlung.
Electrons accelerated in the fields of ions.
Isn't it already in your cooling function? You have to be careful with cooling functions.
In the absence of all of this ionizing radiation.
Yeah, you mean that's the temperature equilibrium?
We have
Bremsstrahlung in the calculation, but I can't tell you how effective it is. I don't recall what fraction goes into thermal Bremsstrahlung that stage.
Temperature is low. Probably not very important.
Yeah, I don't recall now. I can look it up and tell you. So the key point of this is that we have a crucial transition in the evolution of protostar. And even if we change a little bit the particle physics model, we still have that transition. Maybe we occur sooner or later. So we want to explore the consequences of this, and especially one key question is, once we reach this stage, what does really happen? We go into this dark matter heating dominates, and what is next? This is a phase in the stellar evolution, but it could last a very short amount of time, or it could last a very long time. And that is the key question we have. If the star is able to cool through some mechanism, for example, it would just go away. If instead, it's not able to cool, we can stay long. The answer also depends on the accretion rate. If the star keeps accreting matter, it can survive longer in the dark star phase. So before doing that, we checked with Naoki Yoshida, with which we're working. We checked using his code and putting in dark matter annihilation, what would happen. So now this is, again, the temperature density plane. This curve resembles more the simulation curve I showed before because this is from the same code. And now the dark matter annihilation changes the evolution around here. And then at a certain point, you reach this crucial transition into a dark star. So this is running the same numerical code that I showed before. This is a full simulation of the first stars by Yoshida and collaborators. And the same code that was used. And it's just with the addition of dark matter annihilation. So you see what happens here, sort of a numerical confirmation that there is a transition. So now this has everything. You're right. This has thermal Bremsstrahlung. This is everything. No? Go ahead. It's not a cosmological thing, no. Yes. Well, I don't know. No, I don't know. Sorry. Okay, so we have this new stellar phase, dark star supported by dark matter annihilation instead of fusion. Now, the dark matter is less than 2% of the mass of the star, at the beginning at least. It provides the heat source. So somebody told us this is the power of darkness. Now, dark stars are not dark. They shine, actually. So it is of interest to figure out what is the surface temperature. Initially, they are giant stars. They fill Earth's orbit. These are two examples. They take 100 GeV WIMP. The core radius is 17 AUs. The mass is 0.6 solar masses. What is the subsequent evolution, or how long does a dark star phase last? These are the open questions, and we have started to address them. Yes? Yes. Well, these are the masses in the product in the cores.
Yeah.
When the transition occurs, so you follow the simulations, and you reach the transition point, and you read off the mass and the core. These are the numbers I'm quoting here. That's why I say initially.
But you need the dark matter accretion later on, right?
I don't need dark matter accretion later on, but there will be. But I don't need it. So this transition occurs, and what happens next is there could be dark matter accretion after this. Is that clear?
Diego asked if CBAR looked into heating of clusters through dark matter annihilations and found that trying to basically balance the cooling flow catastrophe of dark matter annihilation power, found that you couldn't do it unless you made your halo really, really concentrated. And so basically, is the difference here that the densities are so high that all the products get trapped inside?
Absolutely. The density is very high, much higher than in a cluster.
So how do you define the core radius?
Well, just go back. I have to go a little. Okay. So this is from simulations. You see the gas has a core. So if this is a core and this is the periphery of the gas. So here is the core radius. And the core radius goes down and increases because the gas is contracting. So when I talk about the mass of the star, I'm really using these curves from the simulations.
It is the baryons that I'm measuring.
Yeah, so if you get a transition at 10 to the 10 per centimeter cube, which is here, okay, and you can compute the mass in the core, the baryon mass in the core, and that is the number I'm quoting for the initial mass of the dark star. So, okay, those are. We go forward. Now, so here, when I say at 100 GeV WIMP, the mass of the core is 0.6 m sun. This is the mass and baryons in the core at this density. But so what is the subsequent evolution? Yeah, there's still baryons out there outside the core, and there's still dark matter outside the core. And the radiation now is strong to ionize all the gas in the core. Let me skip this. So the dark matter dissociates the molecular hydrogen and then ionizes the gas. And the protostar now becomes a star. This is a recent work we posted on the archive last week. And is one attempt to study the evolution of the dark stars. So this is what we do. So the initial star has a few solar masses, like I said, that's in the core, in the baryonic core. It accretes more baryons up to the Jeans mass, which I recall is 1,000 solar masses. It becomes very luminous. This will be the effect, our result, between 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 7 solar luminosities. It's rather cool, however, 6 to 10,000 degrees Kelvin, with respect to the usual 30,000 Kelvin and more. There are very few ionizing photons because it's just too cool. And the lifetime is a few million years. So before I show you this result, let me comment on the transparency that I showed. So the question of the lifetime of a dark star is actually subtle. Because it takes a long time for the dark matter to annihilate away. So you can compute the annihilation time of the dark matter as a simple formula from the annihilation rate. And at 10 to the 13 centimeters cube, which is our canonical case, that scale is 600 million years. So that's how long you can have fuel in the dark star, 600 million years. And on top of it, dark matter could still come in from outside and keep going, so keep providing you the fuel. So back to this first calculation of the phase of a dark star. So the lifetime is a few million years. Here's what we do. We assume a polytrope for the star. So we still, yes. I'm going to tell you why. So We at this stage, it's still complicated to run a full energy transfer code. So we have assumed to start with, that the star could be well represented by a polytope. This, you know, it's work by Chandrasekhar at the more than about 100 years ago, showing that if you take a star and you solve the whole transport equations, at the end of the day, you can represent the object as a polytope. And polytope is something in which the pressure is the power of the density. And little n is called the polytropic index. So the polytropic index is 3/2 if you have a convection-dominated star, and it is 3 if you have a radiation-dominated star. And this is for a normal main sequence star. So what we have done here, we still don't know what the exact polytropic index is for a dark star, but we have taken this two as a simple assumption. So it will be between 1.5 and 3. And then we have assumed hydrostatic equilibrium and solved the equation for the polytope. The key condition that we impose is that the luminosity of the star is due to dark matter annihilation. So we change the radius of the star until we match the energy output to the energy input from dark matter. So here's a summary of our results. Is the density profiles, density rho in grams per centimeter cube versus the radius for the baryons up here and the dark matter down here. Now what you see are different curves at different times. So we start with a star that has a few solar masses, two solar masses that would be precise in this case. And then we evolve it. So at 1.1 10 to the 4 years later, we have accreted the mass at a rate of 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year. This is an assumption we made in this paper. I'll comment about it later. So we are now at 14 solar masses. And the time goes by, a million years later, which is the last curve here, we have 1,000 solar masses in the star. So how comes we can go to a million years? That's because the dark matter is still there. As we accrete baryonic mass onto the star, we also accrete a little bit of dark matter. That you see on the right side here, you see the density of dark matter going up because a little more is coming in. On the other hand, at the same time, we're annihilating the dark matter. And so if you look in the core, the density of dark matter is going down. That's because we are annihilating it.
Contraction or?
Adiabatic contraction, yes.
So it is, so I have a quick question. So, if the darker stars will realize the gas, so gas, there will be gas in opposition from dark matter halo, right?
Yes.
So once the gas gets realized, probably no, you will not have gas accretion, baryon accretion, because it's in opposition, no gas cooling.
So how much baryons? Baryon gas is accreted is not very clear. And as I said, here we assume 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year, which is sort of in the middle of the range that you find it for normal population 3 stars. But of course, it could be less, it could be more.
But in the case, there are no ionization photons. But in your case, you have ionization photons.
We do not reach the Eddington luminosity at any stage here. So there's nothing that keeps the baryons out there.
Okay.
So they come in. That is your concern. So where do we go from here? So what happens next? So the outer material accretes onto the core. And we have considered this accretion in a gentle way, but it could be an accretion shock. If we want to study that, we need to perform numerical simulations, and it's something for the future. Then once the fuel runs out, or a million years later, as we saw when we reach 1,000 solar masses, then it may be, and we still haven't reached that stage, it may be at some moment in the future of the dark star, it contracts. If it does so, you know, then it becomes regular main sequence star. You go through the Kelvin-Helmholtz contraction and the deuterium burning and PP chain and CNO cycle. That's all right, but that's absolutely true. We expect an accretion disk around the core. And the work of Selwood and McGaugh shows that the effect of the disk on the adiabatic contraction of dark matter is negligible. And that's what we rely on. So for the world graphs, instead, the baryons and the accretion rate of baryons, if you have a disk or not, it will be very important. So this is why I say, I mean, this is the current stage of the world. This paper was finished last week, so there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. So if the dark star reaches the main sequence eventually, what we have is the population 3 star formation is delayed with consequences for the time of reionization in the universe. Possible effects. Again, there will be many question marks here because we haven't worked everything out. So reionization, as I said, may be delayed due to the later formation of population 2 stars, the stars after the first ones. But it also may be sped up by the dark matter annihilation product. And which one is stronger, we don't know yet. Also, not all of the first stars may be dark stars, because they need to form where there's a high dark matter concentration. So what is the fraction of dark stars that forms? We don't know. Maybe reionization could be achieved by the other population of 3 stars that are not dark. This has observational consequences because it may be studied with upcoming measurements of the 21-centimeter line. Another interesting thing, implication of dark stars, is early black holes. So if you have a 1,000 solar mass star, now you see it's rather heavy. And suppose the dark matter annihilation switches off because it ran out of fuel. Then in a very short time scale, in about 10 years, you just contract into a black hole. And this is so early that you can use it as a seed for the black holes that are observed at high redshift, where the usual accretion process forming these black holes is too slow. Ten to the 3 is not massive enough, but we just stopped at 10 to the 3. Okay. So we could keep going. We just took 1 million years. But you see, why didn't we go longer? It's because you want to verify the chemistry and all that before you really push it to long ages. So observables, dark stars, are giant objects, redshift 10 or 20, with radii about 1 AU, luminosities of 1 million suns, masses of 1,000 M sun. And these numbers may change. So this is just initial work. Maybe we can find them with JWST. We still don't know exactly. We need to know the spectrum. Yes. We need to know the spectrum. We need to do more about the atmosphere of the dark star. Maybe we can detect annihilation products, in particular neutrinos that escape from the dark stars and may form a diffuse neutrino background. And perhaps WIMPs may be discovered via the dark stars, or perhaps we can learn more about the properties of the WIMPs. So these are my conclusions. The dark matter annihilation heating in population 3 protostars can delay or block their formation, and a new stellar phase can arise. Dark stars powered by dark matter annihilation and not by fusion. Thank you.